Welcome to another episode of At the Table with Patrick Lencioni, where everything we talk about is related to organizational health and the world of work. I'm Pat Lencioni, your host, joined by a new crew today. It's really me and Bo on the mic and a special guest, right, Bo?
That's right.
But he's not an outside guest. We don't really do guests on our show. He is one of our new employees. His name is Joel, but we like to call him Joel, and we'll explain that in a second. And we've got Karen and Matt in studio too. Cody is out doing some important work in Texas, so it's just the two of us today, and Tracy had an appointment. So, Bo, what is the topic? What is the subject of our talk today?
Today's episode is called Salud.
Salud. Well, really, that's just a... It's not a typo for salad, because we did one on word salad not too long ago. Salud in Spanish means health. And so we're going to talk about organizational health with a Spanish flavor, because we have with us Joel, who is a young man who works for the Table Group. And today actually is a perfect day to do this, because today is May 1st. We're recording it, and that's May Day. And in different parts of the world, that means different things. In many places, it's kind of like International Labor Day. In Europe, there's festivals and things like that. In the Catholic world, at Mass today, they talked about this is a feast day of St. Joseph, the patron saint of the worker. Now, in communist countries, it tends to be a day where you're kind of celebrating communism, and it's kind of a big deal. And Joel happens to come from a communist country, Cuba, and he left Cuba, escaped, got out 18 months ago. We found him here and hired him. We love having him on our staff, and we thought today would be a very special, fun episode to talk about organizational health in the world of work and society in a communist country as opposed to a country that is not communist or a free market. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. Joel, it's great to have you here. How are you?
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here and being with you guys and sharing these thoughts together. So it's awesome.
That's great. So me and Bo are going to ask a whole bunch of questions, but and go first, Bo.
Yeah, I was just going to say, okay, Joel, give us a little bit of your story. Tell us what you were doing in Cuba and kind of what kind of work you were doing there, a little bit about your situation.
Okay, sure. So I left Cuba because of a very delicate situation right after finishing college. I graduated of nuclear physics, and I was about to start working as an assistant teacher at my home university. There were several things took us away from Cuba, not just me, but also my wife. By being at this position, it was kind of a prestigious place where to be. Not everyone gets to stay at school and be an assistant teacher. But the thing is that although there were a few things that I liked, working as like academy and stuff like that, I will have to fulfill also other roles, more political related roles, because in a country like Cuba, everything is about politics. Politics surpasses anything else. So my role will be, I will have to not only be a good professor, but also need to attempt to pay attention to whatever all my colleagues will be talking about in class. And of course, I'm referring here to political ideas and activities.
So you'd have to report on people who were saying things that didn't coincide with what the government wanted?
Yes, I will have to, yes.
To tell on them, huh?
Mm-hmm. And I will also need to be very active in every activity, a political activity at school, which is like every week, three times every week. I hope to be part of this committee in which the Communist Party will directly instruct to this specific group of people how to behave in the school, what things you can do, what things you cannot do. And everything I will do as a physicist or whatever I would like to do, it will always be related to the state, how it will favor the state, and it more than anything else.
So it wasn't just pursue academic freedom and pursue truth and try to invent things. It's like it all has to do with how it fits within the narrative of the government.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Okay. Wow, that's a long podcast about that alone, but since this is about organizational health, but that's fascinating. So you decided to leave, and so you just announced that you were leaving? How does that work? How do you get out?
No, you gotta be very careful the way you say things. By the time I say I was going to not accept in this position, I was called by several people, colleagues, professors, the dean of the university, head of the nuclear physics department, and they will all ask, why are you leaving? Why are you taking this position? You know, it is very, it's hard to get these kind of positions.
They didn't know you were leaving the country.
No.
They just know that you turned down that job, and that was unheard of for them.
Yes, it was. Yes, exactly. It was like a red flag for them.
So what was your reason, according to them, that you were going to leave the country? Were you going on vacation? Is that what you had to tell them?
Well, actually, by the time I wouldn't be able not even to say I was leaving the country. It was more of I would have to give specific reasons of, you know, extra reasons of why I wouldn't take this position. It would not only be, no, I'm leaving the country. There's no such thing. They actually at one point, they try to say, hey, if you want to leave the country, we can help you with that. But it is, it, of course, it's not a truth. It was more of a matter of like a trap, maybe trying to get me out of base and just to take any repression or I don't know how you say it.
Yeah.
So is job searching or job changing very common in Cuba?
Oh no, it's not actually, because once you're placed. So let me explain this first.
Sure.
Every job in Cuba, right? Every job in Cuba is regulated by the government and it's created by the government, which means all the institutions all are public, all belong to the government. There's no privatization at all. So what happens is that once you get in a position, there's no much, let's say, incentive to move because it's the same everywhere. You will have to do, even if your role is a little different, everything else is the same. So there's no incentive to move ahead and to progress or to change the job because you want to have a better future.
So you don't go like, this is my working genius. I really want to do this. And you're not going to start your own business there or go apply for a job that once you're genius, they kind of tell you where you're going to work?
Oh yeah, they do. And actually, because most, for example, male and even female, because we have two things to do for the government before and after college. Before college is a military service. It's obligated. You need to go there. You have to go there. And by the time you finish, you have to serve the country for at least 2 or 3 years in a place where they want to put you there, and you will just work for them, doing whatever they want you to do. So no, they don't take into account fulfillment or joy or anything like that. It's just a matter of what the government wants. Individuals, they don't matter for the government. It's the purpose itself, it's the ideology what really matters.
So morale, they're not like trying to appeal to the morale of the employee and trying to make them feel good and keep them. They're going to have to stay there anyway.
Yeah, they will have to. And actually they use instead of using joy and fulfillment, they change it for fear. So what people do instead of they don't care about whether you feel joyful or well, this is a job that will suit your skills or your gifts, or no, they don't take into account. Well, actually God doesn't exist for them at all. So what they do is just they say, you know, if you're not here, it's better for you to be here, because if you're not, you will be in a worse place. So it's fear. Everything is around fear, not joy and fulfillment at all.
Joel, I want to double click into a couple things that you said, and pardon my ignorance here. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. When you said all institutions are owned and run by the government, you didn't just mean all colleges.
Everything. And even the small, so for example, telecommunications, right? Here we can have whatever. We can have Verizon, we can have AT&T, whatever you want, right? In Cuba, it's just one, and it's from the government. Everything, transportation, everything belongs to the government. There's nothing that is private.
So if you wanted to get out of school and start a business,
yeah,
like, that's entrepreneurialism is not an option there.
It's not an option. Actually, most people will believe, so if they travel to Cuba and they'll go to restaurants and go to very touristic places, it might sound like there are private restaurants, but the reality is that's not true. The reason why is because there are no places where the restaurant owners or whoever has a bakery, whatever, there are no places for them to buy the goods they need to produce. So everything is through a black market because the government doesn't provide for people. And what happens is that in order for you to succeed, you will need to have somebody helping you and protecting you so the government wouldn't attack you directly. And the only way the government wouldn't attack you is if you are serving them in a certain way. So you have a minister or a general or some high-ranked military guy that will protect you and will provide for you the protection you need so you can do all the legal things you need to succeed.
Wow. So, because Tracy was asking you before we started, she said, before she left, she said, so if you own a restaurant in Cuba, how does that work? And then you were explaining that they couldn't get what they need. So if I have a hamburger stand there and I need to get other goods to sell, where do I get that? Are you just saying the grocery store isn't stocked up on those things?
No, it's empty. It's empty. If you go in the last 4 or 5 years, so Cuba, it's been the same for over, I don't know, 10, 20 years. But if you go to a store today, all you probably will have is water. And actually, food, it's been given to people through like a ticketing system. So you get a ticket and then you go a specific day and you buy that good at the store. But there, I'm telling about here, like, for example, you can buy only 5 eggs or 10 eggs a month per person. That's all you can get. So how are you going to build up a business from there? There's no way.
Wow. So I want to get back to why we're doing this podcast real quick. But but this is fascinating. I mean, this is so fascinating. And what was it like when you went into a grocery store here? Were you just like blown away?
Oh God, that was overwhelming. It was so good that at some point became overwhelming. I remember my wife and I was sort of wondering how come there is so much here. I mean, how's even possible? You can choose in between brands and you can have, you know, tastes and stuff like that. There is no such thing in Cuba. You eat what you have. And here you have so many options and opportunities.
Right. What's amazing is, and there's a business behind every one of those, and there's a company that's selling toothpaste for people with sensitive gums, and somebody started that business, and somebody, you know, that's crazy. Okay. But see, so here's the thing. So let's get through your story real fast. So you, how did you get out of the country?
Oh, so I left the country on, long story, but I did leave the country we went to Mexico. My wife and I, we had a visa to go to Mexico. And in Mexico, the night we arrived, we said, we really had a short window to leave Cuba because I had to report to a military place where they placed me after I said no to the position I was given.
Oh, they were going to, so then you were going to have to go into the military.
Oh yeah. So it's a hospital, but the hospital belongs to the military and everything they do and all the doctors and everyone, they are military. There are no civilians there. So I had a small window to leave before mid-January. And my wife and I, we pray about it and we decided to leave the country because there was no hope for us there. And all I will be given, it will be like a very, very, like I was going to be put in a predicament every day. So we decided, no, this is not a place for us. We have to take the risk and we have to leave.
So did they think you were going on vacation then? I mean, like,
Yes. So we even had to purchase like incredibly overpriced tickets. You have to buy the round trip, not just one way. There is no such thing. And by the time you get to the airport, you gotta look very like a good tourist. There's no, So it's crazy.
Did you feel like if they saw you and you didn't look like you were going for tourism, but that you were actually leaving, that that might flag them and they might do something?
Oh yeah, for sure. And we actually, one thing that helped if any COVID has helped at all, is that we have to use our face masks and we only had to put them down at some point, but we were scared. I mean, if the lady at the custom will have take a look at us, we were pale.
Wow. Okay. So you got to Mexico, you applied for asylum there?
Yeah. So I got to Mexico and then that night my wife and I would talk about it and say, hey, you know, we should pray because it's a tough call and we need to do something. Mexico is not a safe place for us and we need to think about what to do now. And what we decided was to get to the border and to ask for humanitarian assistance, like to apply for asylum case and say, hey, this is my story. This is what happened to me.
Yeah, you're literally leaving a country that doesn't let people leave and you were fearing for your lives. Yeah. Wow. And so then you processed there and you got through and then you
They start the case for you. They put you in prison for a few days, and then they release you and your family. We had family here, which was a blessing for us. And this family, they helped us to get here to California and now where we live.
Crazy. Wow. I mean, I'm not even comfortable moving on because there's just so much there. I mean, everyone listening to this is like, I can't believe I just heard that. And I can't believe that we get to work with you. I mean, we love having you here and we knew your story, but even the nuances and the details of that are every one of those is worth another 45-minute question. Yeah, Bo.
It is. And I'm excited to talk about how this relates back to the world of work. But I wonder if other listeners are thinking this too. Well, is this safe? Joel, like when you're telling us the story and here it is and it's going to live on the internet, tell us how you feel about that. And we did ask you this before we hit record.
Yeah.
But so counter to how we live day to day, how do you feel about this going out to the world?
So by the time I got here to the US, I still was afraid of speaking loud. And sometimes we gather to our family and everyone and we were like, it's just like you did in Cuba. When you gather to family, you want to talk about politics and how huge the lack of freedom you have. You had to do it like in very low tone. And that was our feeling by the time we were right here. But now I have gotten to see and to realize that there's nothing to be afraid of. And I have the opportunity to not only tell my story, but also encourage others to value what they have and to fight for it. If I'm afraid at all, will be at a certain point for some people that are back in Cuba. But the ones that I can think of, they don't give a damn. They just rather me to be open and to tell what I know and what I know is right and is truth, rather than just to be quiet. So sure.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, thank you for sharing it.
Not sure.
Yes. Oh, this is amazing. We did not know exactly how this would go, and this is fantastic. By the way, the thread, as we like to say in this podcast, is that what I want to say is that organizational health is predicated on a free economy, a free market, because in a place like Cuba, where the employee has not a lot of choices, there's no capital, there's no business, private business or anything like that, organizational health would seem crazy because it's not a competitive advantage. And the idea that managers would manage in an enlightened way just doesn't make sense because like the individual, it doesn't matter. They don't have choices. There's no competition. If you don't manage your people well, there's nowhere else for them to go and there's no competition anyway. So I think that's one of the interesting things about this. And I would like to talk to you about, so you've had two jobs since you got to the United States. And so tell us what it's based on what you've saw there and what you see here. What is it like? What do you notice about the world of work and the world of commerce?
So what I've noticed is that what you do matters. And if you do it better and if you do it more efficiently and in a better way, you'll get rewarded for it. And you can see there are opportunities. You can see life and work as levels instead of just a plateau. That you just get there and just want to live for the rest 40, 50 years in that position and then die. It's more of I want to belong to this place and I want to do my best for it. And when you do that, it commonly becomes people are interested in using you in different ways and having you do better and more in what you do at some point, what you like and what you're better at. So the thing is that, so here, the businesses, either because they really care about profits or they care about profits and organizational health and they see the value of it. In either way, even if they're doing it indirectly or directly, they know that if the employee is doing what they know to do best and they are enjoying it and they are striving in it, then they will try to put the employee there because they want that. They want to take the best out of it.
There's a competitive advantage, a reward, and a reason to put yourself out there.
Yeah, for sure.
And I also hear there's more dignity. There is actually good to be able to work to contribute to something, to be able to be seen, challenged, and have your work
you can belong
matter.
You can belong. In Cuba, you cannot belong. No one belongs to anywhere. In here, you can belong to the place where you work, and you can do it voluntarily.
Wow.
Now, you know what's amazing, Joel? You and I talked about this last week when we saw this. So today is May Day. They have big parades usually in Cuba because in communist countries, it's like, ironically, they're like, we're the workers' paradise. You know, that's what Russia said in their days of communism, the Soviet Union and North Korea and Venezuela. They're like, oh, the workers' paradise. And they were supposed to have a big parade today, but they canceled it because there's no gasoline.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so tell me, I mean, isn't it funny? We're talking about the fact that workers don't have a lot of choice. There's not a lot of upside, but it's a workers' paradise. How do they explain that, do you think?
So the thing is, everything is about lies. In a country like Cuba, what helps you best is to learn how to figure out lies that they tell. So let me give you an example. So if you go to a May 1st march that they have portrayed it to the world, like you can see all the Cubans supporting the government, the state, and the communism and all this stuff. So the reality is that most of those Cubans were going there. Because if they wouldn't, they wouldn't get a little over how you say when you do something, it's not profit sharing. It's like, for example, if you do this, we will give you extra rice or beans this month.
Rations. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Exactly. So
you go to the parade because that's going to get you what you need to survive.
And if you don't, then they mark you and you know you can be in trouble in the near future. And also, you know what's also funny? Is that in Cuba, the amount of cars per capita is extremely low. So what happened is that they have to fill the buses, the government buses, with the employees. So they don't have even the gasoline to get all those people that they're not going voluntarily to these places. Okay, but the way that they think, and I kind of understand it, is if I don't, it's not just me who goes down. It's also my family who relies on me. And I don't have any other way to support my family than the one I have right now.
Mm. So wow, that's hardly a worker's paradise.
And it is not like ideology or not ideology. It's family against family. So you cannot, the opportunity cost is way too high.
What's fascinating about this is we grew up hearing stories about what a communist country is like and, you know, all these places, but to actually hear it from a young person who was there very recently, and it's almost beyond belief that it happens like this. And so one question I have to ask is, you said, if you don't go to the parade, who rats you out? Who tells on you or who writes you up?
Oh, many people. It can be either. So you have supervisors everywhere you are. And most of the people that are supervisors, they are directly indoctrinated by the government, especially indoctrinated by the government. So their job is to snitch on you. So if their extra rice and beans come from telling that you didn't go to the parade.
Wow.
So that's how, and if they don't, then you have your colleagues that probably, if they tell that you didn't go, they will get extra rice and beans for them going and not you going and just telling that you didn't go.
Well, so I am so glad that you are here. I mean, so what is from a standpoint of the work experience and working in a company and all those other, what is the message you would want to say to people here about valuing that and about protecting it? Like, how, tell us from your words, what does that mean to you?
What it means to me is that most people trying to diminish and underestimate the value of freedom. And they only get to see how valuable it is when they don't have it. And when you have freedom, you have always people that, when you have freedom, you are also giving and opening doors for people to take it away from you. And you have to be careful with that. Wow. And when you're seeing from a work perspective, to be in a place where people value what you do and people value you beyond what you can produce, but yet they are more interested on you to feel fulfillment and that bring in more production. That is something that only happens here in an open market world. And I think most people, and I kind of understand it. If you have never experienced anything different, you won't see the value of it.
Wow.
But if you have experienced something different, or at least if you know there is so much worse out there, then I will encourage you to value it.
Well, that's great. And you know, what I think that what is so hard for us to remember and easy to take for granted is that when it is a competitive advantage to treat people better,
yeah,
because they are happier, more loyal, they brag about the company, and they work harder, that's where dignity comes from. Even if a business owner is kind of self-interested, it benefits them to do what's best for the employee.
Yeah.
And yet when there's no competition, when a good business can't succeed and a bad one won't fail, and when things are all equal, then we lose the incentive to treat our people well. And ironically, that creates a worker's misery. Mm-hmm. And so and we don't think about this a lot because 99.9% of the work I've done has had nothing to do with countries that don't do that. I haven't done work in pseudo-communist countries. I just haven't. But it makes sense that they don't actually call us because they would think like, why would we waste time and energy on that? It doesn't matter here.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's a stark reminder to me that we need to appreciate this here. And we love having you here. And of course, one of the things is somebody who gets out of Cuba and comes here and appreciates it, man, do they work hard. Joel has a degree in nuclear physics.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'll do anything.
And luckily now, we had a physics opening in our physics department.
We were just starting up that nuclear accelerator and we were like, perfect for Joel. But the good news is beyond nuclear physics, we found out what his working geniuses are. And we're putting those to use here. And it's a wonderful thing. And we're so glad to do it. And I want to thank you, Joel, for taking us through that. And I feel badly. I feel like I could go for two more hours just on the human side of this story. And I really admire you. But thanks for sharing that with our listeners. And that's a very special episode and a unique one. We've never done anything like this. And thanks for bringing that to us, Joel.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure for me being part of this amazing team and do the things that we are doing. And they are so needed out there. So it is a blessing for me, for sure.
Wonderful. All righty. Well, thanks so much, Joel and Bo and everybody else. And that's it for us today. And we'll talk to you next time on At the Table. God bless you.